loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Walter Smolarek, sitting in for John Kiriakou, and joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, cancer is not only traumatic and deadly, but it can be incredibly expensive to treat. One organization, Value in Cancer Care Consortium, has been working on cutting those costs to make cancer treatment more readily available. And for one treatment, the researchers were able to confirm that just one-third of a drug for blood cancer was just as effective as the previously recommended dose. This would, of course, cut the treatment costs by a third, until Janssen and Pharmacyclics tripled their prices in response. Next, the Department of Health and Human Services is reportedly planning to issue regulations that will further restrict undocumented people's ability to access healthcare. We'll take an in-depth look today and tomorrow at this latest attack on immigrants and the barriers to healthcare access that already existed. Then, yesterday evening, Charles County, Maryland residents rallied at the town council building to protest fracking and a potential new fracked gas compressor station. Fracking is a problem nationwide that is hazardous to the environment and to the people living nearby. And then, Puerto Rico suffered a huge blackout yesterday, leaving the entire island without power, which has still not yet been fully restored. Months after Puerto Rico was hit with a devastating hurricane, critical infrastructure is still yet to be repaired. And finally, the Syrian army has given ISIS a 48-hour deadline to vacate areas south of the capital Damascus, primarily the Palestinian refugee camp of Yarmouk, which has suffered under ISIS's brutal rule since the spring of 2015. Meanwhile, controversy continues to swirl over the alleged chemical weapons attack in Douma. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear.
Cancer is not only traumatic and deadly, but it can be incredibly expensive to treat. One organization, Value in Cancer Care Consortium, has been working on cutting those costs to make cancer treatment more readily available. And for one treatment, the researchers were able to confirm that just one-third of a drug for blood cancer was just as effective as the previously recommended dose. This would, of course, you would think, cut the treatment cost by one-third, until Janssen and Pharmacyclics, the pharmaceutical that manufactures this drug, tripled their price in response. We're joined from Sarasota, Florida, by Dr. Alan Lichter. He's an oncologist and a chair of the board of directors of the Value in Cancer Care Consortium, the research organization that was able to confirm medical efficacy for lower levels of treatment. From 2006 to 2016, he also served as the CEO of the American Society of Clinical Oncology. Dr. Lichter, thank you for joining.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I read the Washington Post story this morning. The headline was, "Science hinted that cancer patients could take less of a $148,000 a year drug. Its maker tripled the price of a pill." It's an amazing story. Tell us what this is.
The scientific part of this story is in its early stages. This is a drug called ibrutinib. It has the trade name of Imbruvica. And it's used for certain types of blood cancers, leukemias and lymphomas. When the drug was approved, it was approved for a dose of 420 milligrams. The drug was on the market in capsules of 140 milligrams, so you took three of them. And the drug was priced in a linear fashion. By that we mean each milligram was charged at about a dollar a milligram, which is expensive as it is. So if you took the full dose, you were paying $420 basically per dose. That's how you start getting up into the hundreds of thousands of dollars of expense. When the drug came out and got FDA approval, the company's own research showed that the biologic effect that this drug was designed to produce was produced at much lower doses. But they came out with the recommended dose at this higher dose. And then some very early studies in small numbers of patients began to show that a dose of one-third, 140 milligrams, was enough to produce the same biologic effect. So I want to make it clear that we Our plan was to do a formal study to prove that the one-third dose was just as good. And we were lining up all the pieces we needed to do this study. And all of a sudden, out of the blue, maybe it was a coincidence, but all of a sudden, the 140-milligram capsule is removed from the market. It's replaced by individual tablets, and the tablets are 420 or 280 or 140. But every tablet costs the same $420. So all of a sudden, it doesn't matter whether we show that the lower dose is just as good. It doesn't matter, at least from a cost perspective, because the company has now ensured that the high price that patients take for the full label dose of the drug will persist, even if we can show that a smaller dose is just as effective. That is a huge disappointment. The company says, of course, they did it all for patient convenience because it is less arduous to take one pill a day versus three, and we agree. But they could have done that, and they could have left the pricing the same so that the 140-milligram dose was priced at $140, not $420. So basically, they have immunize themselves against any price reduction in any way, shape, and form.
So it's already a very expensive drug, even if you cut it by a third, which of course would be very, very important. We're looking at a treatment regimen that costs, it says, $148,000 a year in the headline. So you cut that by a third, you know, you're still in the $40,000 to $50,000 range in order to get this needed treatment. Why are these drugs so expensive? Why does it cost $148,000 to begin with, and or $50,000 if it was cut by a third? And also, why? I mean, you're because I think you're being diplomatic when you say it could be a coincidence, but it seems like that this company, which is making pharmaceuticals because they want to make profits from the pharmaceuticals, they're not really about patient treatment per se. They're looking at their investors and drawing capital and drawing investment. How can they get away with this? Why is that legal? I know that's a layperson's question, but it just strikes me as like, how could this be legal?
Well, first of all, why does it cost so much? It costs so much because it can. The laws that Congress has passed make it so that the Food and Drug Administration cannot consider cost when they evaluate a drug for approval, and says Medicare must provide the drug if the FDA approves it for a cancer indication. So that's a perfect recipe for prices to just go off the charts. And in fact, over the last 2 to 3 decades, that's exactly what they have done. Back in the early 2000s, drug prices were hitting $30,000 and $40,000 a year, and people were concerned and outraged, and then they went up to $75,000, and then they went up to $100,000, and then they are now approaching $150,000. And this will not stop because there is nothing in a regulatory environment, there is nothing to prevent it from stopping. What this does is put tremendous pressure on the financial resources of cancer patients all over this country, because for many of these drugs, there are copays. And those copays were put in place when drugs cost $10 or $20, or if you're taking a generic blood pressure pill, you know, these pills can these prescriptions can cost, you know, $10 and $20. But, you know, who anticipated that a small percentage copay would end up being applied to a $150,000 drug? This is a financial calamity. Yes, if we reduced it down to a third, it would still be an enormous cost. But it would relieve some of the pressure that our patients are feeling.
Yeah, it could be make or break it for many families. I mean, I think that I don't have the exact number, and you may know it, but I think as many as 50% of personal bankruptcies in America are a consequence of unpaid medical bills. I'm looking at, we have only about 2.5 minutes left. Looking at a Washington Post story from 3 months ago, it says this old drug was free. Now it's $109,500 a year. And it's about a treatment that was originally indicated for glaucoma when the FDA licensed it in 1958. But people were treating it for other problems, including temporary bouts of immobility and muscle weakness caused by a genetic illness. It was free, virtually free, then a little bit more expensive, now $109,000. Again, even within, it's hard for us to understand, the public to understand, in this regulatory schema, how a price of a drug can bounce around with this kind of dynamism, such profound differences.
Well, you know, a drug comes out and is under patent. So the drug Imbruvica we're just talking about is patent protected until about 2030. So there, unless another company makes a similar agent, there's no competition. And even when companies make similar indications with patented drugs, typically the new drug comes in and takes advantage of charging the same price as the old drug. So there's really not a lot of competition. But when drugs go generic, that is their patent expires and many manufacturers can make them, the price competition does kick in, and the drug costs, the price of the drug goes down and often plummets. But for some older generics, very shrewd companies have realized that if they can get to a point where they're the only ones making this drug, it is open season. They can charge whatever they want. If you are a patient that needs this drug, that's what you need. And there are countless stories of drugs that were invented in the 50s and 60s, and as you say, you know, cost these days essentially nothing. And where the production was cornered by a single organization and the price went through the roof. This is the famous story of Martin Shkreli, who's now convicted of securities fraud, but that's what he did with his drug Diaprim that went from $1.50 to $750 overnight. The best way that we know of right now is to say let's groups of physicians like the Value in Cancer Care Consortium do the clinical studies to show that we can use less of these drugs and use them more wisely and use them more efficiently. And doctors are behind this work. In this case, we've had a little roadblock in this particular pricing structure, but there are dozens of other cancer drugs that we will be studying to show how to use them better without reducing their anti-cancer properties. And for many of these drugs, Imbruvica being an example, the less dose you use, the lower the side effects.
Lower the side effects, lower the price. Yeah, we're completely out of time. I want to thank you, Dr. Alan Lichter. Alan Lichter is an oncologist, and he's the chairperson of the board of directors of the Value in Cancer Care Consortium. I want to also thank you just for doing the work that you're doing and the work that the other doctors are doing. If people want to learn very quickly, we have about 15 seconds left. If they want to learn about Value in Cancer Care Consortium, where do they go?
Go to our website, vic3.org.
All right, we're going to leave it right there. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Nicole Roussel, sitting in for John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Today, we're looking at healthcare for immigrant populations and the huge obstacles that immigrant families face right now in this country. The Department of Health and Human Services is reportedly planning to issue regulations that would further restrict undocumented people's ability to access healthcare. We'll take an in-depth look today and tomorrow at this latest attack on immigrants and the barriers to healthcare access that have already existed. We are joined in studio by Leo Cuello, an attorney and the director of health policy for the National Health Law Program. Welcome, Leo.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us, what are these regulations that are about to come out?
So we're expecting regulations on what is known as public charge. And these regulations could come out any day now and will set things back quite a bit. The public charge rule is basically one that sets out when immigrants are one day hoping to become permanent residents and they're applying for permanent residency. One of the things that will be looked at is, have they been a public charge? Have they been using public funds? And that can be a basis for actually denying them their permanent residence. And so we luckily have this wonderful longstanding policy that food programs, health programs don't count against you. And so immigrants shouldn't be afraid to apply for those programs. And the Trump administration is reviewing that policy, and that will create major fear in applying for programs.
Okay. So this is one of the really big obstacles that is faced by immigrant populations here in the U.S. So I think we're going to get more into that in our segment with you tomorrow. But today, to start with, I'm not actually sure. What does healthcare coverage look like for immigrants? If you immigrate here, what are you actually able to get in terms of healthcare access and coverage?
Right. So overall, the picture isn't great. Immigrants are more likely to be uninsured. Lawful immigrants are two times as likely to be uninsured. Immigrants who are undocumented are four times more likely to be uninsured. And that's for a combination of reasons in the private and public coverage markets. So if you kind of start with the private market, what we see is that private insurance, employer-based insurance, that whole system largely fails immigrant communities. Just to give you like a shocking example, for Latino children, one in three of them will have sort of employer or private coverage through their parents. That number is two out of three for white children, right? So we are not talking about trivial differences. We're talking about really significant numbers of immigrants who do not get covered through that private or employer market, probably because many of them are working low-wage jobs, right, that don't offer insurance, but a host of other reasons that we can talk about as well.
And that's obviously a huge disparity, a third for Latino children compared with two-thirds for white children. But it's also just a really low number on its own. That's only 33% of Latino kids who actually have access to healthcare, which, especially as a child, can be really impactful moving on as an adult. If you're able to do preventive care, if you're able to get the things you need when you're a child, you have much better health outcomes later on. Isn't that right?
That's right. So there's two points here. The first is that while that's the number of Latino children who get access through private or employer coverage, there is a significant number, about 50%, that get coverage through Medicaid. That number is only like a third for white children. So what you can see is that the Medicaid program, the public coverage program, is doing extra work to kind of pick up the slack of that private market system and cover those children who aren't getting covered through the private market system. Now, the other point that's really important that you're raising is the reason that whether or not people have health insurance is so important. I mean, you might ask, well, why do we care if people have health insurance, right? You could still go to the hospital. You could still go to the doctor. Of course, people can't afford to pay out of pocket. But it's not just that. It's also that when you have health insurance, right, you have access to primary care, right, preventive visits. You have access to chronic care. So like if you need, you have asthma and you need inhalers and that kind of thing, you get those paid for. You, of course, have access to emergency care, meaning you can both use emergency care and also don't get bankrupted because you used your emergency care, which is what happens now to a lot of people. And you can get other types of care like rehabilitative care or longer-term care for a child with a disability. So if you don't have an insurance that provides you with that comprehensive range of coverage, you will be missing pieces to your coverage, even if you do have a local clinic where you might get your primary care, but you can't get your chronic care to manage your diabetes maybe or whatever the case may be. So it's really significant. And that's why when people have insurance, they are likely to live in better health, report better function, report less pain, and sadly, actually live longer.
And this also, I imagine, intersects with poverty and housing issues too, because we know that people who are living in poor communities often are the folks who are settled with nearby nuclear plants or who have, you know, are living in conditions that might have mold in the house or have these increased likelihoods of having asthma or having other conditions that they might need health care for.
Yeah, it works both ways. It's that they have more things that they need health care for, but it's also that to solve the health care problems, we have to address a whole wider range of issues. So, for example, if you have a child that is has lead-based paint in their house, you will never successfully provide health care to help them recover on their developmental trajectory if you're not resolving the lead-based paint problem, right? And so the healthcare system for all people has to get into the business of understanding what is going on with this individual's life more broadly. But in the case of immigrants, there are so many more factors, right? Some may not have access to nutrition. Some may have toxic environments. So there are all of these reasons why the healthcare system has to be even better at catching them. And that's why Medicaid is so important. We should talk a little bit about how the Medicaid system works and how it varies by state.
Oh, that's exactly right. Yeah. So how does healthcare vary by geography, both for Medicaid, but more broadly for immigrant populations?
Right. So Medicaid covers many immigrants. That's the first thing people don't understand. But there are also many immigrants who don't get coverage in Medicaid because they are not in one of the official qualified statuses. And some of those people who aren't eligible are here legally. There are people with student visas or people here on a business visa who actually aren't eligible for our Medicaid system. The second reason is that even people who are eligible for Medicaid may be barred from entering the program in their first 5 years. So all of that to say, we have this population of people here who are legal immigrants, some of them legal permanent residents, who can't get into the Medicaid program.
But just real quick on that, so why would they be barred for 5 years?
Because there's actually a provision of law that says during the first 5 years, you're not eligible for Medicaid. So you can't get, even if you are of an immigrant status, you're a legal permanent resident, you are somebody who is eligible for Medicaid, during the first 5 years, there's a bar. So after those first 5 years, then you can be eligible.
Let's just talk for a moment about that, because there's something called public health policy, because health isn't just purely individual, it's also public. Like, let's say I'm an undocumented family or an immigrant family that yet can't get health care for 5 years, not eligible for 5 years, and my kids need to get flu shots, don't get flu shots, they get the flu, and then they go to school with the kids who can get health care. I mean, how does that make any sense from the point of view of public health policy, which of course impacts all people's health?
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, one of the misconceptions is that this problem is isolated to the immigrant population. When it affects us on a public health level, it affects us on an economic level, right? Because these are individuals who are working and actually producing a lot for this economy. And if they're not healthy, they don't work. And it actually hurts everybody in terms of the economy. So they're all of these reasons that are kind of practical reasons. And I think many of us would say also health is a human right. So these people should have health care just as much as we would agree they should have water. So I think, you know, that is spot on as a concern. There's no rational good explanation for the five-year bar other than to say we want to kind of discourage people who we think are going to arrive here and want to use public services. And it's just not a smart policy.
You know, I went to Mexico during the Zapatista uprising to cover it. And I was in Chiapas and blah, blah, blah. And one of the guys I was with, a journalist, an American, got very, very sick. And we had to rush him to the hospital. We thought, gosh, he's going to die because maybe he had an infection or something. In the hospital in Mexico, he was treated. We waited to get him out. We waited for the bill. There was no bill. I mean, he's an American in Mexico, and yet the healthcare system was such that he just got treated.
And that's, you know, in the United States, that same scenario might lead you to have a $20,000 bill that collectors hassle you over, that ruins your credit, that might lead you to be bankrupt, that influences your ability to one day buy a house, right? Just it can kind of have a devastating spillover of effects, might lead you to not get follow-up treatment, which results in some bad outcome.
We have 1 minute left, and we're going to continue this interview, Leo. But healthcare should be a human right, must be a human right. But even from the economics of the thing, I have a friend who is a doctor in a Spanish-speaking clinic treating immigrant populations in Tacoma Park. She says the people come in, they're much sicker. If they have cancer, the cancers are advanced. The treatment plan thus must be more expensive. And ultimately, especially if people don't have any place else to go, they end up going to the hospital. Even from an economic point of view, I mean, even if you dismiss the issue of rights, this makes no sense economically.
Yeah, that's exactly right. We know that if we forestall treatment, if people don't have access to preventive care, we end up paying much more later to, you know, get them healthy. And also, they have worse outcomes. So it's not like you get the same outcome if you start treating cancer late than you start treating it early. And they live worse, right? During the 2 years that they wait before they go get treatment, they have some problem that they live with that, again, influences all these other aspects of life, their ability to take care of their kids, go to school, et cetera.
That's all the time we have for now. We're going to continue talking about this very important issue of how immigrants' rights and healthcare interacts. We've been joined in studio by Leo Cuello, an attorney and the director of health policy for the National Health Law Program. Tune in again tomorrow to hear the second part of this interview with Leo. But that's all the time we have for now. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Yesterday evening, Charles County, Maryland residents rallied at the town council building to protest fracking and a potential new fracked gas compressor station. Fracking is a huge problem nationwide that poses grave hazards to the environment and to the people living nearby. We're joined from Maryland by Kelly Canavan. She is a Maryland anti-fracking organizer with AMP Creeks Council, who was a key organizer in the rally yesterday. Welcome, Kelly.
Thank you so much. Glad to be with you.
So tell us about the rally. What were the main issues? Tell us about this fracked gas compressor station.
The rally was terrific. We actually rallied at the Maryland Department of the Environment. And the reason for that is that they are in the middle of considering whether or not to grant an air quality permit to the fracked gas compressor station that Dominion wants to build in Charles County. It's called Charles Station. And they have responsibility for reviewing a lot of other fracked gas infrastructure. And that's really what the rally was about. It was focusing hard on this particular compressor station, but also on the incredible proposed build-out of fracked gas infrastructure across Maryland.
So even though Maryland has a ban on fracking itself, the infrastructure for processing the gas, that's still being constructed is what you're saying, right?
Yeah. In fact, the gigantic Cove Point export terminal, another Dominion project, recently began functioning in Calvert County, Maryland. That was after a year of delay, but a great deal of fighting to stop that thing. And unfortunately, Maryland officials were just dead set on it going forward. And also a compressor station in Myersville, Maryland, which was built against the wishes also of the town of Myersville and has since been expanded. So there's not only that practice infrastructure, but also there is a proposed compressor station in Charles County near the Prince George's County line. There's a proposed power plant in Brandywine in Prince George's County. There's the proposed Potomac pipeline, which has just received approvals from Governor Hogan. And there's also build out in Denton that's proposed on the Eastern Shore. So it really is getting to be a problem in all the sectors of Maryland. It's not just one little thing anymore.
So, of course, natural gas is a fossil fuel. It emits carbon into the atmosphere. It contributes, you know, greatly to climate change. But in terms of the more immediate effects on the ground, I mean, what are some of the reasons why people, you know, don't want fracking in their communities? What are the health consequences that go along with this particular type of gas extraction?
There are a lot of them, and the studies that are documenting them into hard science are becoming more and more numerous by the day, but also are still young because, of course, peer-reviewed scientific studies take time. And also because fracking can differ a little bit from place to place since we don't know what is used in fracking fluid, and that can vary from company to company. It's a proprietary recipe, and that was something that Dick Cheney had a hand in making possible, that we don't get to know what is actually used in fracking fluid. So that means we also don't know what happens, when fracking fluid leaches into well water, for example. We don't know which chemicals exactly are potentially poisoning us. There is a huge issue with methane and other chemicals being released into the air at fracking well sites, and also at infrastructure. At infrastructure, and along pipelines, the emissions are called fugitive emissions, and that's because they're sort of the emissions that are escaping through all of the seals and the joints in the project, and they are many. So there really is a lot of gas and a lot of chemicals that are being released into the environment that are not even regulated or measured in any particular way.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. We're talking with Kelly Canavan. She's a Maryland anti-fracking organizer, about a recent rally that was held in Charles County against the construction of fracking infrastructure. You are listening to Loud and Clear. You can check us out on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio, and you can also find us on Facebook, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker. So, Kelly, I mean, the process of fracking is horrible. I mean, they have this chemical mix, which is, you know, it's called hydraulic fracturing. And, you know, there's water involved, but there's lots of other chemicals involved as well. And they fire it down into the ground, and they try to shatter the shale formations, or whatever formations the gas is trapped in, and then suck that up. So, I mean, are there carcinogens that they use? Like, what kind of chemicals are they introducing into the environment? And like you said, that very frequently seep into people's drinking waters.
Yeah, things like benzene, formaldehyde. There are so many of them. There was a really terrific study done on compressor stations in New York State. One of the authors, that was Pat Russo. I can't remember his partner's name, unfortunately, but after that study was released, soon after, that was when New York State decided to ban fracking, and actually when Governor Cuomo was seen like holding a study in his hand saying that he wouldn't want this near his kids, that was what he was holding, was that study. But what it documents is these many chemicals, as many chemicals as they can, that are being released, and how many of them are carcinogenic or toxic. And there are about 20 that they flag as being really, really problematic. And to think even one or two really, really problematic chemicals being released into our environment is bad enough, but 20 is ridiculous.
The gas corporations, I mean, the people who are profiting off of this like incredibly hazardous process, this incredibly hazardous method of natural gas extraction, they're very well connected politically. Tell us a little bit about how, you know, even if fracking, the process itself, is banned in Maryland, how, you know, these companies that are profiting off of, for instance, the frack gas compressor station that you all were protesting yesterday, tell us about the political influence of those corporations.
Sure. Dominion, I think it's well known, is a multi-billion dollar corporation, and generally seen to be sort of running the show in Virginia, although fortunately their grip is being loosened a little bit there by some of the braver politicians who have decided not to take Dominion money anymore. But that is not the case everywhere else. And in fact, in Maryland, it seems that politicians can't get enough of it. So Dominion really, really has this ugly pattern of doing things like entering into secret or non-disclosure agreements with politicians. They did that in Calvert County with the Calvert County commissioners. They've done it in other places as well. And then they weasel their way into these pilot programs, these payments in lieu of taxes programs, so that they aren't even giving back in that way, you know, through paying a lot of taxes. Not that it would make up for the damage that they're doing, but also just through direct contributions to political campaigns. They wield a lot of influence.
Yeah, so the frackers, the polluters, I mean, they have the money, but, you know, we have the people, right? The opponents of this process, you know, are doing exactly what you're doing, right? Organizing demonstrations, grassroots efforts. tell us about how the Maryland fracking ban, you know, this is the ban, of course, on the extraction and not, you know, what we're just talking about the gas compressor station. Tell us about the organizing that won that victory.
Sure. So that organizing went on for years and years and, you know, through multiple election cycles. And it was a statewide effort. You know, there aren't a lot of people in Maryland who are paying attention to environmental issues who can't claim some hand in that victory, because it really took everybody to force our lawmakers' hands and finally get that ban passed. It was a monumental group effort. So, you know, it's, and I don't mean to minimize it in any way. You know, it is something that I absolutely rejoiced over and continue to rejoice over, but it is small comfort when the infrastructure is still seeping into our communities. You know, it's an absolute pox, and it drives fracking in other people's communities. So in neighboring states, it's still pushing fracking. And ultimately that has negative impacts on us as well through pushing climate change.
We have just about 30 seconds left. For our listeners, how can they get involved in the work that you all are doing with Amp Creeks Council?
They can jump on our website, which is ampcreeks.org. They can look up wearecovepoint.org, and there are ways to get in touch with us through both of those websites. We would love to have everybody on board to help, and we'll be in touch with them directly to let them know what to do. They also can send comments to the Maryland Department of the Environment asking that the Charles Station Compressor Station project be denied an air quality permit, and they can call Brian Frosch and Andrea Baker, the attorney generals who are pushing for approval of the project.
Okay, we're going to leave it right there. We've been joined from Maryland by Kelly Canavan. She is a Maryland anti-fracking organizer with Amp Creeks Council, who is a key organizer in the rally yesterday against a new frack gas compressor station. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Yesterday, Puerto Rico suffered yet another huge island-wide blackout. This comes after last week's power outage for 840,000 residents, including the airport, San Juan's biggest hospital, a light rail line, and the biggest mall. The company that was hired to help with both of these outages have been fired. We're joined from Puerto Rico by Camilo Ponsoda. He is a spokesperson for Juventud Trabajadora, the youth wing of the Working People's Party of Puerto Rico. Welcome back, Camilo.
Thanks for having me once again on the show.
So this is a major blow to residents of Puerto Rico. Tell us about how the blackout has disrupted everyday life.
Well, I mean, blackouts with like this magnitude affect more than smaller blackouts. This was the main line. The whole island was without power. So that means, like you said, hospitals, the airport, the traffic was horrible since the few traffic lights that we have working weren't working anymore. The connections for the receptions for cell phones are horrible after the power goes out, and our water system works with pumps that if the electricity is not there and power plants are not working and the generators are not working, then it will happen what happened here in Rio Grande yesterday, that the water service got interrupted as well. So yeah, that brings a lot of consequences. It's not just not having power in your house. It's a lot more complicated than that.
Yeah, and I mean, that seriously puts people's lives at risk. I mean, like if you're in a hospital, right, you know, you just have to hope that hospital's generator works.
Exactly, yeah, pretty much.
So this is not the first time that there's been an island-wide power outage. The electrical grid, even though it's been suffering for a long time because of, you know, the underdevelopment that's been imposed on Puerto Rico, tell us about the state of the island's infrastructure 7 months, maybe even closer to 8 months after Hurricane Maria and Irma.
Well, it's very poor infrastructure. Obviously, about a week ago, we had another power outage that was pretty big. It affected the whole metropolitan area. And it was because Cobra Electric, the company that was hired, one of the companies that was hired to rebuild the electric system of Puerto Rico, let a tree branch fall on the power lines. So as we can see, the electric system is very deteriorated, very sensitive, and the next hurricane season is just around the corner, actually. So that's very that worries me a lot, at least. And the fact that the government doesn't have a plan for emergencies just after a year after, not even 7 months after the hurricane, just comes to show the priorities of the government of Puerto Rico and the government of the United States as well.
Yeah, it's completely disgusting. And you're right. I mean, the next hurricane season is right around the corner. I mean, in, you know, maybe just a couple months, I think 43 days. So, but perhaps, I mean, perhaps this is the government's plan. Talk about the privatization push that's being directed at PREPA.
Yeah, I was going to talk about that. I think that there is the fact that the power system in Puerto Rico, its generation, its distribution, it is deteriorated, but there is a lack of enthusiasm to fix it in order to go to public entity. Obviously, the government of Puerto Rico is trying to sell this, so it could be, and it probably is. They're being negligent with the power system, perhaps to get the country in favor of the privatization of the system. There's a lot of entities in Puerto Rico that are already looking to buy the electric system, and today is when the Fiscal Control Board is going to be approving these fiscal plans that contemplate the selling the public agencies of the government of Puerto Rico. So yeah, the government has been looking for excuses. As I said in a past interview with you guys, they found a perfect excuse with Maria and Irma, not only to sell the electric system, but also the public education system. So we're seeing privatization all around that.
And tell us what the Fiscal Control Board is. I mean, it's such a blatantly colonial institution. What is the Fiscal Control Board, and how was it imposed on the island?
The Fiscal Control Board was implemented back in Obama's last term as president under the PROMESA bill. The Fiscal Control Board is composed of 7 members who were not elected democratically, rather imposed by Congress. Their function in the island was originally to manage the government finances in order to pay the debt apply austerity measures in order to pay that debt. But obviously that there's a lot more to it than just that, because they're now starting to interfere with the rights of the working people in the private sector, such as reducing their vacation days and their sick days, and their ability to go to court for unjustified firing. So they're obviously up to a lot more than just managing the island's finances. It's a colonial board. It's here to dictate, basically.
Yeah, and if the Fiscal Control Board succeeds in its efforts to privatize the electrical grid, do you anticipate prices to go up on consumers?
Of course. What we got to understand is that private entities are there to bring, they guarantee a service if it's effective money-wise for them. So obviously, I mean, there have been studies from individual groups in Puerto Rico who have been looking for transparency in the government, and have been doing independent audits of the debt and some other subjects and topics. And the fact is that the monthly payments are going to raise, yeah, once the electricity is privatized.
Yeah, are the workers at PREPA unionized?
Yeah, UTIER is the union for the PREPA network, yeah.
Yeah, so privatization may also have the effect of busting up that union, or at least significantly weakening it.
It would definitely bring a lot of consequences, raises in prices, and also the way that electricity is generated is going to be questioned as well. We all know that AES, which is the one who's responsible for producing a lot of the energy in Puerto Rico, is burning charcoal. down in the south, which ends up being deposited in the island as well. The ashes, and that's toxic. So there's a lot of questioning how the energy is going to be generated and fares for the electricity as well.
You're listening to Loud and Clear. You can find us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio, or you can find us on Facebook with Loud and Clear with Brian Becker. We're talking with Camilo Pansori. He's a spokesperson for Juventud Trabajadora. That's the youth wing of the Working People's Party of Puerto Rico. We're talking about the massive power outage that occurred in Puerto Rico. Still, there are many parts of the island without power even today. Camilo, tell us about the difference in how rural areas have experienced the blackouts and also the reconstruction efforts in general. I mean, there are certain parts of Puerto Rico that are still really completely devastated, even all these months after the storms.
Yeah, obviously the government's going to put priority to the metropolitan area because a lot of the economy moves in the city. But the negligence, to the extent that it is, that they're, how they're not taking care of rural areas is worrying. There's a lot of places that 7 months after Hurricane Maria still have no power. So the people that just lost power really don't know when they're going to get it back. There's really no interest in building the electric wires back into the island, into the middle of the island, Utuado, and a lot of places that are not reachable are without communication. There's a lot of places that are still without receptions for their cell phones, who are having troubles in the road, who just can't get to where they have to go. And the government has completely neglected the rural areas of Puerto Rico.
The Trump administration's response to the disaster in Puerto Rico, I mean, in my opinion, was just completely disgusting. I mean, well, you know, first of all, prior to the storm, I mean, he wasn't worried about, you know, Puerto Rico or getting the response ready. What he was doing was tweeting about how upset he was that black football players were protesting racism and police brutality. And then, you know, after the storm, not only is the recovery work, like you've been laying out, you know, completely inadequate, it's also been seen as an opportunity for huge corporations to loot the island. We've been talking about the possible privatization of the electrical grid. But there are also these contracting firms. I have in mind particularly Whitefish Energy that got a lot of the electrical or the contracts for the electrical repair work. Tell us about Whitefish Energy and the scandal around that.
Yeah, Whitefish Energy, just as the Cobra Energy were founded, were created not even a year ago. Originally, Whitefish was given a $300 million contract to rebuild the power grid of Puerto Rico. Actually, the line that got affected last Thursday was the line that Whitefish actually was supposed to fix. These companies all have a scheme. Obviously, they were created for this occasion. They have no experience whatsoever, and they're doing their debut in Puerto Rico. And this is their first big project, and that's not acceptable. This is not a business. This is our lives that we're talking here. So this is not an opportunity for your first job to put on your resume. This is human lives that we're talking here. And the government is putting very poor attention to the subject and is being very negligent, giving contracts out to companies that don't have the credentials to do the job that is supposed to be done.
We're out of time. We're going to leave it right there. We've been joined from San Juan by Camilo Pansora, his spokesperson for Juventud Trabajadora, the youth wing of the Working People's Party of Puerto Rico. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The Syrian army has given ISIS a 48-hour deadline to vacate areas south of the capital, Damascus, primarily the Palestinian refugee camp of Yarmouk, which has suffered under ISIS's brutal rule since the spring of 2015. Meanwhile, controversy continues to swirl over the alleged chemical weapons attack in Douma. We're joined from London by Masoud Shajarey. He is the founder of the Islamic Human Rights Commission. Welcome back, Masoud. So tell us about this latest announcement from the Syrian army. Let's start there. Yarmouk been under ISIS control since 2015. What do you make of this 48-hour deadline?
Well, I think it sort of goes along with the the process that the Syrian government, the Syrian army have been involved in with the help and support of their allies, Russia and Iran, and indeed Hezbollah. They have been the most effective tool against Daesh and extremism. And if it wasn't because of this effort, this collective effort, I think we would have seen huge parts of Syria, if not all of it, and indeed huge part of Iraq being under control of Daesh. And it would have indeed, from what we were seeing happening just a couple of years ago, probably extended elsewhere. So what we are seeing now, it really is the probably sort of extension of that process, which is to some extent have been extremely successful, because Daesh does not really exist as a state anymore, cannot really claim that it is a state. And it's just a sort of small enclaves controlled by some of their members. And indeed, that needs to be cleaned up from the area for the benefits of the local people, and indeed benefits of others. I mean, let's face it, you know, the West keeps on talking about the sort of the danger of extremism and terrorism and Daesh, and indeed have paid sort of quite heavily with the sort of attack of the Islamic State in Europe and elsewhere. And but they never have done anything to actually stop it. If anything, I want to reemphasize, if it wasn't because of the involvement of Syrian government, Syria and Syrian armed forces, with the help of their Russian, Iranian and Hezbollah, we wouldn't have seen this success. And in reality, if indeed the West, under the leadership of the United States, is interested in getting rid of Daesh, they should have actually done a lot more independently. And indeed, they should have been welcoming and supporting these efforts, which they haven't done so.
Masoud, let me ask you, what's ISIS' position in this Palestinian refugee camp in Yarmouk? Do they have a base of support within the camp, or are they just simply imposing a military occupation over the people living as refugees there?
Well, there are a lot of claim and counterclaim, but if you look at the liberated areas, even the most recent liberated areas, and you talk and media have been able to independently go and interview people. People have been liberated. People are saying that, when you ask them, why didn't you leave and continuously stayed in this hellhole, they say very clearly that we weren't allowed to leave. We were actually, being shot at and so forth. So they were hostages. Forgetting about claim and counterclaim, but the evidence that we have seen from liberated areas right across, that is the reality. And even when people were given the freedom of leaving and going to another area, only sort of those extreme elements which were involved in conflict have left. Majority of people feel that they should have been liberated. So I don't see any difference in here than anywhere else. I mean, we have seen the nature of Daesh, wherever they have been, is so brutal that no one in the right state of mind would want to live under that sort of regime. And in reality, the Muslims have been the biggest victims of Daesh, and the local Muslims have been, the most victim of it, be it Palestinians or anything else. The extremism And you know, it's not even extremism. I don't even want to use the word extremism. The sort of barbaric policies that they have, it actually goes against the grain of everybody. And let us not forget, Syria was, to some extent, more free and more, you know, Palestinians in Syria, unlike Palestinians anywhere else in sort of the region, in the rest of the Muslim countries, including Lebanon and so forth, they were free to go anywhere. And they actually integrated into that society. Syrians opened their doors to the Palestinian community, and they actually accepted them as their brethren. This didn't happen even in Jordan or elsewhere. And I think, you know, it didn't happen in the rest of the Arab world. And, you know, for them then to be subjugated to barbaric actions of Daesh, you know, you can't sort of come to any conclusion that they are anything but sort of occupied by brutal force and against their.
So in the Yarmouk camp, the refugee camp, the Palestinian camp, I don't know that camp. I mean, I've been to Sabra and Shatila in Lebanon. People are able to go back and forth. Are people able to get employment in Syria?
The Palestinians in Syria were much freer than anywhere else. Definitely much more freer than sort of Lebanon. As a matter of fact, you know, when you traveled, even the sort of position and the honor and the support which was given to Palestinian resistance in Syria was exceptional. I mean, I've been there many times before this conflict was engineered. And Palestinian leadership, Hamas leadership, were really getting a lot of support, protection, and everything that they could have possibly asked for. That sort of treatment does not exist for them in anywhere else. It didn't exist for them anywhere else then. It doesn't exist for them anywhere else now. They have become basically the biggest losers. And, you know, the integration of the Palestinians in Syrian society was far more above anywhere else in the region. And that's something that, you know, everyone, those supporters and opponents of the Syrian government, will testify to that. That's a factual.
Masoud, let me ask you, we only have about 2 minutes left. At the time that the war started in Syria in 2011, I believe there may have been, I'm only knowing this from media reports, so it might not be accurate, perhaps 110,000 people living in Yarmouk. By a year ago, or by 2 years ago, that number was down to 7,000 or 8,000 residents who were left in the camp. Is that your understanding as well, that this has been largely drained of people? And also, in our last 90 seconds or so, will this be an intense battle?
It will be an intense battle, I believe, because these are the last bits and pieces that they control. And so they really are going to fight for it. But as regard as, you know, people leaving, it actually is a testimony to the fact that they don't want to live under Daesh. You know, it really is. I mean, nobody will. I wouldn't. You know, and you know, I'm a committed practicing Muslim. The last thing I want is to live under Daesh. I would prefer to live anywhere but that. You know, even occupied territories is better. Brutal occupation is actually better than that. And so, by that definition, it's not really surprising people have left. And you know, I have to say there is another fact, and that is that one of the greatest sort of victims of this sort of conflict and promotion of this conflict in Syria have been the Palestinians, because they lost something that they didn't have anywhere else. And they became basically homeless for a second time.
We've been joined from London by Masoud Shajarey. He is the founder of the Islamic Human Rights Commission.
We're completely out of time. We'll be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and you want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. You can also follow us at Loud Clear Radio on Twitter. If you're in the Washington, D.C. area, you can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, 4 to 6 p.m. at 105.5 FM and at 1390 AM. You can also subscribe to it as a podcast at iTunes. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.